freedom of religion and freedom from religion with Betty and Paul Picard. For those of you who are new in the village this afternoon, or if you're just new to a session with us, I'd like to tell you how pleased we are that you're here. You're most welcome. And I'd like, if you haven't heard us before, I'd like you to know how pleased we are that we're here. We're just having a great time. We've got a very good impression of Holden Village in our 3 days so far, and we're looking forward to the rest of our stay. In proposing what we might do in the village, we gave Larry a long list of topics, and then when we got around to arranging them and scheduling them, it just happened that the ones where I was going to do most of the talking came up first. But if you'll be patient with us, Betty will take the lead in our next session when we get around to talking about poverty. So again, out of my background in political science, not as a lawyer, we'll try and talk today about some of the problems of church and state. I want you to understand my own position at the outset. And the simplest statement of it that I could come up with is that, in my view, God does not need the patronage of any politician. And there are a lot of corollaries that flow from that. And the first one is that I've got a very low opinion of politicians who take a really cheap shot at the problem by catering to the unthinking, uncritical predilections of their constituents. This is especially a problem for politicians who come from constituencies with relatively homogeneous populations, where the population shares, for our purposes this afternoon, a religious conviction. Then it becomes very easy for the politicians to cater to that, to pander to that, in a way that could hardly be thought of as very religious or very constructive. A second thing I'd like you to know is that both of us, like many of you who are Lutherans, both of us come out of a tradition in which our church historically was the established church. Betty's a Catholic, and many of you have a very keen and good understanding of what happens when the Catholics establish a church in a country like Spain or in a country like Germany before the Reformation. My religious tradition is Episcopalian, Anglican, and the Anglican Church is still established in England, but it was established in several of the American colonies. And at the time of the creation of the Union, many states, many of the 13 states, had established the Episcopal Church. And when you hear me questioning the desirability of an established church, I hope you'll give me credit for criticizing not the establishment of your church, but the establishment of mine. It wasn't a good thing for the Episcopal Church to be established. It generated a bunch of lazy, drunken clergymen. Certainly not without exceptions. I'm sure there were many saints among the clergy, but the church generally was a lazy, ineffective, uninfluential church in the life of the community. And the established Church of England today attracts such a minuscule percentage of the population as to make a farce out of the notion that England has an Anglican church. There's a very small royal establishment that goes through the motions of religion, and is a very, very small part of the population that tagged along. The contrast that we found in our travels that's most striking to us is the church in Poland. There, friends, is a church. There is a church not filled with old women, but with people of all ages and both sexes. We went to Mass in March in Krakow, in the downtown church, and this cathedral was so mobbed. Excuse me, I don't think it was the cathedral, it's the central old city church. It was so mobbed that we only had places to stand, but that before the Mass was over, crowds of people for the next Mass were coming in so that they could get a seat, because they knew if they waited till it was time for their Mass, they wouldn't get a seat. And this, we went by some other churches that Sunday morning, and we could see the same thing going on there. It wasn't just that everybody was coming downtown to church. To claim to be a Christian in Poland is to spit in the teeth of the government, a government which has been a communist government for a generation, and those people witness to their faith in Christ in a way that you and I don't when we go to church. It's no big thing for us, is it? We kind of expect approval for it. And they do it as an act of defiance. So take a position against the establishment of a church, against the establishment of religion, is not in any sense to take a position against religion. I see it quite the other way, as a defense of religion, as a way to witness, in the case of most of us, perhaps all of us here, to witness our Christianity. The Constitution says in the First Amendment, Congress shall pass no law or make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. We have two constitutional provisions. One, the Establishment Clause, forbidding the government to establish a religion, and secondly, a free exercise clause for forbidding the government to prohibit the free exercise of religion. To start with, as the words say, that was a limitation on Congress. Congress shall pass no law. But with the conclusion of the Civil War and the readjustment of the relations between the central government and the states had a new limitation imposed on them. It wasn't the First Amendment limitation to start with. It was couched in more general language that the states are required by the national constitution after the Civil War to guarantee to all citizens the privileges and immunities of citizenship. And they are forbidden to deny any person, whether a citizen or not, life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And they're forbidden to deny any person equal protection of the law. And in starting in the 1920s, really in my own lifetime, the Supreme Court of the United States has construed these 14th Amendment principles of life, liberty, and property and equal protection to include the First Amendment freedoms, so that starting roughly in a 6 or 7 year period from 1924 to 1931 or two, somewhere along in there, we can read the 14th Amendment as saying no state can deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And by liberty, we mean freedom of religion, protection against establishment of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, freedom of petition. So that those six great fundamental rights of the Bill of Rights of the First Amendment are now incorporated in the 14th Amendment, so that neither the national government under the First Amendment nor any state or city, county, local government under the 14th Amendment can establish a religion or prohibit the free exercise of religion. Well, that's not enough said, is it? That's That's the document, that's the paper, that's a series of court decisions. What does it mean, and how can it be applied in specific cases when you get down to individual cases? And what I thought we could do to move on with this is to try and pick out, and I'll try and jot them down on the board with you, the kind of specific questions that will be of interest to us this afternoon. I hope I've already paid attention to whichever one you mentioned. If you come up with a new one, we'll just wrestle with it together. None? I've got a list this long myself, but I want your list. Yes?
Government support for church-related colleges.
Very good. Can I just say education? And we may concentrate on the college and universities. We may want to get down to some of the elementary schools as well. I found out when I was sitting back there that when the speaker stands up, he disappears.
How about taxing of church property?
All right.
Active of church-owned businesses.
Yes. All right. Yes. So there are two kinds of taxes for churches to deal with: the tax on the church as a place of worship, and the tax on the real estate, perhaps, that the church holds as an investment. Yes?
God in the public schools?
Yes. I was going to say school prayers.
It's actually more inclusive than just the prayer issue.
Yes, God. That's God in the public schools. Where I come from, a lot of people like to say that the Supreme Court took God out of the schools and put the blacks in.
Florida?
Yeah, but I think it's unfair to couple those two. And certainly many people can be concerned with the one and not the other. But it is a warning signal, isn't it, already, to see the ability of some people to couple those two notions.
Well, that would include religious Christmas program.
Yes.
Isn't.
Yes, the Christmas pageant, or the Hanukkah pageant.
Well, I was thinking also, for example, I think the Mormon Church owns a UNI sugar company. I'm talking about profits.
Yes.
Income tax.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Not only Mormons, but other churches also have tremendous investments that earn income.
Business buildings.
Christian.
Some other issues? Yes, sir.
One more. Well, the Washington for Jesus movement, in the sense that the church wants to make social pronouncements and therefore lobby for those things in Washington. And the question is whether that organization then is deserving of exemption for taxation.
Yes. Let me come in. You're still raising a tax question, and the question becomes, what is a church that might be entitled to an exemption, and what's a political organization that might not be? But I thought perhaps you were going to raise another very important question. Graham, perhaps you are. The question about the propriety of religious groups trying to penetrate the wall of separation of church between church and state in order to get the state to enact their religious convictions. That's an issue which I would not want us to ignore, because it seemed to me one that's most easily misunderstood. So
I'll just, for shorthand here, just say religious lobbying.
What about In God We Trust on the money?
Let's see, we can broaden that a bit because it's In God We Trust as a national motto that's used on our money, but it's also put into the pledge. It's also put into the third stanza of the Star Spangled Banner. The pledge and the Star Spangled Banner both enacted by the Congress in my lifetime again. The tape can't see how old I am, but I was born in 1924, so references to my lifetime may sound to some of you pretty historic, but others of you will recognize it as just yesterday.
Yes. You're also taking the oath in court on the Bible.
Yes. Oaths for witnesses, but the problem came up first in this country, perhaps in terms of oaths for holding public office. And again, fairly recently, into the 20th century, that was an issue. Let's work on those a little bit. Yes, please.
I'm not sure what you call this, but in California, the Supreme Court says, you know, that it's all right for the state to look into abuses inside the church, you know, like that People's Temple, and then other groups like Pat Robinson, for example, says that, you know, they're very much against that the state could look into abuses. But then I'm thinking, well, what do the people in the church do if they are being rooked or something? They won't have anyone to go to if they can't go to the state to get their money back or whatever it is.
Isn't there an investigation now in terms of the Worldwide Church group, Armstrong? Or
yes, there is, but you see there's that difference of philosophy about whether or not the state has a right.
Yeah,
it
has a right, because
that.
If that can be subject to...
Does that label kind of shorthand for what you're saying?
Something like that.
What is the public interest in the internal affairs of the church? Comes up, some of you may... I don't think the Episcopal Church is terribly important in this country, but they do some fascinating things, don't they? Like ordaining women and changing a prayer book, as a result of which some congregations want to split off. And then who owns the property? And it's hard for the Episcopalians as Christians to resolve the problem of who owns the property. So they go to the public courts and they ask the secular judges to solve the problem for them. Well, let's work on those a little, and maybe some others will occur to you. And if we're interested, I can perhaps just by reading the rest of my list to you help to indicate how terribly long and complicated the problem is. Just from this list, we can see, I hope we can see, that an important part of the problem is the tension between these two constitutional requirements, that there are situations in which one either observes the Establishment Clause or one observes the Free Exercise Clause, but one cannot observe both. To treat religion in an absolutely neutral way, for the government to absolutely ignore religion, to give full force to the non-establishment clause, would be to violate the free exercise clause. For example, on oaths, if the government says, we treat everybody alike, we don't treat religious people differently, because if we
if we give something special to people who are religious, that is establishing religion, giving an advantage there as against other people who would not get that advantage. It would be a tempting position for the government. And many people ask the government to do exactly that, to be absolutely neutral, not to give people anything for religion. But to treat everybody like that would be to deny some people their freedom of religion, wouldn't it? If your religion prohibits the taking of an oath, and the government requires an oath of you, either for giving testimony in court or for holding a public office, then it is denying you your freedom of religion, isn't it?
How about bearing arms? Is that the same idea?
Yes, I'm surprised that didn't come up much sooner. The problem of the conscientious objector to military service is one of the more difficult ones, and it's become much more difficult in our day, in very recent time, the last 10 years, than it was when I was of military age. When I was of military age, it was a very simple problem. You let the Quakers off scot-free, Jehovah's Witnesses, the seminary students and the clergy, they all got off scot-free, and then you hassle the Catholics if they claimed it, because everybody knew the Catholic Church wasn't against war. But some Catholics, being very devout, concerned about the pacifism of Jesus, weren't going along with the traditions of their own church, and were they entitled to exemption? But it was therefore relatively simple, and the war, those of you my age remember, was so popular. It was the easiest thing in the world to con an 18-year-old kid into going out and joining the armed forces. And as soon as he did, everybody treated him like he was just, you know, a really fine, fine fellow. I once came out here to Washington, the only other time I've been out here. I came out on a troop train. They were sending us POE out of Seattle. And every time the train stopped, there were bunches of ladies knocked themselves out to give us coffee, donuts, make us feel good, make us feel important. It was a wonderful kind of mood. So it wasn't much of a problem. Betty and I have a good friend, a young man who in high school introduced us to each other, who was a pacifist, a conscientious objector during the war. Very important to me. He and I had long, long arguments before I went in the Army and he went to civilian public service. While I was in combat, I got pacifist literature from this man, urging me to be a pacifist. While I was committed, well, not the minute, you know, we'd come back for meals and they'd pull us out of the line and we'd get some food and some mail and that kind of stuff. But literally the same day, I'd get this pacifist literature. And I said, there really is a difference, isn't there, between the American way that I'm standing up for and the Nazi way. So I thought it was a good thing to have those conscientious objectors around. And I thought it was especially good after the war that there were some of them around to help the process of reconciliation, to help the healing process that's so important, where we did a much better job, didn't we, after World War II than we did after World War I. And after World War I, you know, we just gave ourselves a 20-year recess, not a real peace at all. And now we got a whole generation of Germans and French who've grown up without killing each other. Very unusual. But today, today, we got a lot of other kinds of conscientious objectors. Not these mainline denominational beliefs, but we got those whose beliefs are much more just humanist or ethical rather than religious. How shall we treat them? And then we have perhaps the toughest nut of all to crack. And that's the guy who won't even say, I'm a pacifist. He just says, I'm not going to fight in this ungodly war or in this mistaken war. If we were fighting World War II again or Korea again, I'd be right in there. That's the right thing to do. There's a case for a just war. But here's a war, on the other hand, which I can't fight in, which would be against my conscience. You know, I'll go to jail before I'll fight it. I'll go to Canada. But no, the ones who stay here, I'll go to jail before I'll fight in that war. What about them? You see, that's a much tougher nut. If you start allowing everybody an individual judgment about which wars to support and which wars to sit out, you might not get enough support sometime when you wanted to. Then you might not be able to fight the war. Wouldn't that be terrible? Yes.
You just happened to touch on the question I was going to raise, which is how about the definition of religion?
Yes.
That there's a gray area between religious belief and moral persuasion.
Yes.
And in a nation where the word is contained in the Constitution, it becomes particularly important to establish what it actually means.
Yes. This is certainly the frontier of the law today. In the 18th century, when this language was written, I think it was fairly straightforward, although Jefferson's a very complicated guy. Unitarians like to claim him, and some other people like to claim him. It's not exactly clear what his religious convictions were. Madison also. They're, in some respects, pretty much a part of the establishment. In other respects, they were rather free thinkers. So it's hard to say. But at any rate, it seems to us that religion was easily defined in the 18th century. They really didn't worry even about Jews, much less about atheists and agnostics. And today, we do. Our prisons, for example, have been confronted by Muslims who expect to get the same kind of religious treatment that the Christian prisoners get. And the spread into these non-traditional religions, non-traditional for America, has complicated. And then those just simply don't call it religion, but just call it belief, they call it conscience. And to what extent do we as a nation want to extend the protections of our constitutional law to people of conscience who do not even claim to believe in God? I'm tempted to be very generous about that because I'm very skeptical about our ability to distinguish between those who claim to believe in God sincerely and those who claim to believe in God conveniently. I'm not sure that I can tell the difference between the two, and if I can't, maybe I can avoid the problem by saying, well, I don't care whether you claim it's a belief in God or not. I'll deal with the substance of your position. Yes.
I'd like to talk about the religious lobbying.
Yes, thank you.
And
you got an idea for us?
Well, I subscribe, or I don't subscribe, but I get this stuff from Jerry Falwell here, Lynchburg, Virginia. And here's a picture. I just got this one the other day, and I get stuff from Oral Roberts and from Robert Schuller and some other people. But this one, I want to ask the question, I guess, about what you think about the new right, the kind of fundamentalist Christian religions in the United States, as sort of personified in Jerry Falwell, getting so cozy with Reagan, and if there's any historical precedence for that, what the whole connection between religion and state, what connections are being brought to the surface here. See, here's a picture of Jerry Falwell with Ronald Reagan the night Reagan was nominated. So, I mean, Falwell is so powerful now in this country that he can get into the suite to see Reagan the night he's nominated. And inside, this whole tabloid is basically saying that if you're Christian, you will vote for Reagan. Kind of, I mean, it just goes on and on with that. All sorts of photographs with Mrs. Falwell and Reagan and stuff. And he has this thing called the Clean Up America Club. And if you're a Christian, you're willing to wear the flag. You wear a little flag lapel pin he sends on. Could you speak for a while to the question of first, is this new? Maybe this is an old thing that's going on here.
Yes.
And then at what point is Falwell out of line, or do we all do all religious groups want to lobby the Congress? The Quakers lobby the Democrats in order to get more pacifist legislation in, or why do I get so nervous about Falwell?
Maybe
he's doing something that the Lutheran people do all the time, and maybe I just don't recognize it or something.
Let me start my response the same way I answer my own students when they ask me my personal opinion on something, my personal belief on something. My position isn't very important to you. There's no real point in me giving my position, except if it helps you develop yours. Your position is important to you. What you think about it is important to you, not what I think about it. I have no authority. I have no stature that will let you shortcut your own responsibility and lay it off on me. So when I have the temerity to answer your question, believe me, I answer it in all modesty. I have opinions, which I have spent a long time, in some cases a long time working them out, and I've got in many cases, I've got a very high opinion of my own opinion. I find that I'm willing to revise a lot of them, and I do keep changing them, particularly in this area of church and state. I find it best to be a little fluid. The next part of your question was, is there a tradition for this? And the answer is most certainly. It's a very old practice. As far as I can imagine, it goes all the way back long before Christianity. The commingling of politics and religion is very, very traditional. The really old primitive societies did not even try to make a distinction between religion and politics. If you were a member of the tribe, if you were a member of the community, that meant both the religion and the politics. And I would just tell you that the same people who brought you Nixon and Agnew are now bringing you Reagan and Bush. And if you remember, you've got to remember Nixon's prayer breakfast with Billy Graham. Mm-hmm. So you know, really without asking, that there is precedent for this. And it's not just a Protestant precedent. The politicians of Massachusetts have made a career out of being altar boys and having their picture taken with the cardinal. Certainly in other countries, Catholic countries, other Protestant countries, the mingling is up front. Some of us are talking about Norway. Some of you feel closer kinship for Norway. You recognize there the establishment of one particular Christian sect. Seemed to be a very popular sect around Holden Village. So there is a background for it. Now, the next thing I want to say, I think maybe you'll find this more helpful, and that is that in my view, the wall of separation between church and state is not a very solid wall. It is punctured with all kinds of holes. Some of these holes seem to me to be noxious, and I'd like to see them plugged up. But I am very much in favor of, I think it's entirely appropriate to have holes going one way through that wall all the time. I think it's entirely appropriate for people with religious convictions to try to persuade the politicians to create a government that will reflect their desires. I think that's the only thing that goes on in all politics, is that people have desires and they try to get those desires made into public policy. In a monarchy or a dictatorship, This means very few people get to have their desires made public policy. The more democratic a system, the more people can have that kind of input, can try to have that kind of influence. And it seems to me entirely appropriate that those of us who have a religious conviction try to influence politics. Why not? Why, on what basis would it be appropriate to hobble a person with religious convictions and say that only the non-religious people can legitimately try to influence government? Now, I think just put in those general terms, that's fairly easy for us to accept. But what we find is that it gets to be difficult with certain kinds of issues. And for me, the helpful thing is to keep thinking about different issues. It bugs the hell out of a lot of Southern Baptists to think of the government dictating policies on birth control. And it bugs the hell out of a lot of New England Catholics to think of the government dictating laws on the consumption of alcoholic beverages. So it seemed to me helpful for Southern Baptists to think about birth control, and for New England Catholics, Massachusetts Catholics, to think about prohibition when they start talking about the proper role of lobbying in government.
You said that backwards.
Mm-hmm. No, I want the Catholic. See, the Catholics resent the prohibition laws. I want the Catholics to see that their attitude towards prohibition laws is appropriate for the contraceptive laws. That's why I didn't think I said it backwards. I want the Catholics to remember prohibition where they feel sensitive, when it comes time to birth control, where they don't feel so sensitive. And I want the Baptists to do it the other way, to think about the one that they're sensitive about while they're dealing with the one that they're rather insensitive about. And I say that with the hope that they both become more sensitive and perhaps more modest in their lobbying, and that they not lobby for certain kinds of public policies which are frankly sectarian. But think about the more important public policies. Now, I don't know any civilized regime in history for many thousand years over the whole globe that does not outlaw murder. Now, there are a lot of them, they allow killing of various sorts. You know, in the United States, we allow all kinds of killing. The state of Florida, where I come from, is very much in favor of killing prisoners. We've got more prisoners lined up waiting to be killed than any state in the Union. I don't know exactly why this is. Probably a bunch of Yankees come down to Florida and make trouble. But at any rate, while we're in favor of killing some prisoners, we do object to certain kinds of killings, which we call murder. And that's widespread around history in the world. Now, is anyone going to say, oh, the state mustn't pass a law against murder because that's in the Ten Commandments? And the Ten Commandments are religious. And it's wrong for the state to pass a religious law. See, I think that's nonsense. I think it is religious. It's a religious teaching. It's in a Bible, which only a minority of the world's population regards as holy writ. But so what? We who are against murder are entitled to lobby our politicians to pass laws to try and minimize murder. Like, some people think they can outlaw it. Well, you know, that we will. The fundamental truths about us is that we are brother killers, and nobody's ever been able to put an end to it with any law, but we're entitled to try. And if in our judgment, if in our religious conviction, it appropriate for the state to pass a law against murder? I don't think any non-believer, any constitutional lawyer, has got a leg to stand on in telling us we can't lobby for that.
I have a question.
Yes.
You know, he said this material came out from a church. Caldwell, is that what you said?
Caldwell. We
don't hear very much about it in California. We hear, you know, the others, but we don't hear him. But what would happen if in the Lutheran Standard or in Billy Graham's paper, the Presbyterian paper, they came out and said, now, all of you vote Republican? Wouldn't there be a real... I don't think we'd stand for that, would we?
That's awesome. I don't think that.
Well, I won't tell you what you stand for in a Lutheran publication, but what normally happens in a large group of people who are brought together for religious purposes, they have different political interpretations of their own religion, and so the church tends to play it down the middle. It would seem to me not a very strong position for the church to take. I really resent the church, which says both sides in combat, go to it, boys. Have at each other, kill each other off. I think it is appropriate for a church to take a stand and to pretend that there's no difference in from a religious point of view, that there's no difference between a political appeal based. Well, I don't want
to. He's saying it's appropriate to take a stand on an issue, but not necessarily on an election or a candidate.
But What else is the election but a manifestation of the issues?
Yeah.
If you can't see any difference between Reagan and Carter, then I think you can ask your church to sit it out. But if you can see the difference, I don't see why you can't ask your church to give voice to that difference. Now, there'd be hell to tell you, wouldn't there? But as a matter of practice, down at the pulpit level, this is what happens.
But maybe this is where those of us that are, you know, in the preaching game, you've got this division of church and state, and so when those of us get in the pulpit and talk about issues that are related to politics, the shit hit the fan, and it's like, you know, Pastor, we don't want to hear politics. We just want to hear the gospel.
Yeah, but that's very well, it's a cop-out.
Well, sure it is, but yeah. I mean, that's what folks are saying.
Yes.
And so the men and women who are in the pulpit and talk about issues and relate it in terms of the obedience to God and the gospel, you know, it isn't that ministers are talking about politics and stuff all the time, but there's enough times when you do risk and you share, and then it hits the proverbial other fan.
Yeah, I think they're always talking politics. I don't think you can talk about morality, about behavior of people in society without talking about politics. Now, maybe there's some very esoteric religious issues that just don't have anything to do with living in the world. But apart from those, whenever a preacher is talking about living in the world, the preacher is talking politics. And what most preachers seem to me to do under the guise of not talking politics is to give their benediction to a certain kind of middle-class conservatism. And the only time they get burned, the only time the stuff you're talking about hits the fan, I don't know if the tape picked up your word.
The tape can handle it.
Is when they talk liberal politics. I never heard of a clergyman being condemned for being conservative, for keeping his hands off the hot potatoes, and saying, in effect, what the influential part of his congregation is comfortable hearing, what will not interfere with their ballot, will not interfere with their talk at the country club, will not interfere with their joining the secret brotherhood and so on. That clergyman doesn't take any heat, does he, or she?
Mr. Picard?
Yes.
If you were to pursue this all the way to its end, you know, the pastor can preach politics, or at least talk about the social and political implications of the gospel, how far then do you think that the church ought to go to see, to have what is being said implemented in actual politics?
Right. Well, I suppose the standard here has to be what kind of politics was Jesus into? What was the, you know, what political position did Jesus take? And I think what we see there is a man who did not participate directly in the political process. He didn't live in a democracy. He didn't have a problem with marshaling votes. He didn't have a Congress that he could lobby. So there are certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of political action he didn't get into. And we might well say the same thing for his church today. A certain kind of action in politics might be inappropriate. But the position seem to me what it's all about.
Well, I'm trying to get back to his question, where he said, you know, these Washington for Jesus, or his follower group, or Armstrong, and now the identification with Reagan. If it's correct for the church to obviously talk about the political implications of the gospel, then how far does it go? And if it can go all the way, then what's wrong with what Paul was doing, his identification with Reagan? And shouldn't the church generally identify itself with one party or the other when it comes to any kind of election?
Well, it, as a matter of practical politics, it's not smart for the church to do it, is it? This is why the Pope could sit out World War II. That's a matter of just good practical politics for the church to be so ambiguous that all the Republicans in the church and all the Democrats in the church will continue to support the church. And the church won't have any influence on whether they're Republicans or Democrats. Now, if we stop talking about Republicans and Democrats, we start talking about American political parties versus atheistic communist parties. Does anybody have a problem with their church getting into it?
No.
Does anybody have a problem with their church taking a stand against atheistic communism? So what's going on? That it's good for the church to be in some kind of politics and not good for the church to be in another kind of politics. Well, all I'm trying to argue here is just that the separation of church and state, this constitutional principle, seems to me to be a one-way street. To prohibit the government from interfering with the church, not to prohibit the church from interfering with the government. That's my basic thesis there. And it's a kind of judgment which I don't have any authority to make for anybody else, whether those clergy who support Reagan are making a mistake or not, or those clergy who support Carter are making a mistake or not. That's not for me to say for anybody except for myself. And I don't have any trouble. And I answer that in terms of my own politics. The principle that they are entitled to participate in politics is very clear to me. And that's what I'm defending. So this is perhaps another one of those cases where I'll defend these right-wing churches in their right to take a position on the right, to defend all the plutocrats, defend all the aristocracy, to rationalize all the exploitation, all the oppression, in effect, to defend the status quo against the tempering reforms from the left. If that's their judgment, they're entitled to express it. I disagree with them, but with Voltaire, I approve of their freedom to be wrong. I think they're wrong. Maybe I'm the one who's wrong. So that's why that freedom is so important to me, because I want them to respect my right to take the other position, and I want them to respect the right of my pastor to take some left-leaning positions in politics. My pastor isn't really tempted to take very many left-leaning positions, but he is kind of soft on criminals, and he's kind of soft on homosexuals, and he's tolerant of a lot more variation in life than used to be thought of as traditional in the church.
What I disagree with is that, you know, the moral majority, the tactics that they can use to unseat a person like George McGovern with lies and all those kinds of tactics, which, you know, and you can, and the thing about the flag and moving from a religion that is cultural and nationalistic. And so far, it seems to me, from the kind of thing that Christ is talking about, That's what I really disagree about, and that's what I want to speak against, and that's what I think we need to do in our churches, to let people know about the insidious kind of stuff that's going on with some of these groups.
Can I add that one thing I think we're assuming that I don't think is true, and it follows you, is that religious lobbying necessarily does represent Christianity, or more narrowly, Jesus' view of society. I don't think that it does. I think it's no more than any other special interest group.
Like the Teamsters, yeah, or anything.
A certain respect, like it's really powerful because people say it is religious lobbying. To me, it takes away, you know, our other freedoms if it is implemented, if it goes so far as to be implemented. But I think that to me, I have to always remind myself that religious lobbying, what is it really representing?
Well, I'm willing to give all these people their sincerity. I'm willing to say he's not a scoundrel. I think some of them are, but I'm not willing to say to any one of them, you're a scoundrel. That's a judgment I just can't make. They may honestly believe the way to fulfill the gospel is to have a fascist dictatorship that puts everybody in their place and everybody, by God, behaves the way they're meant to. There may be people who honestly, sincerely, devoutly believe that. That's not my problem. I'll give anybody their own sincerity. We're still left with the substance of the argument, aren't we? And that's where we have to fight it out with them. You're going to be on one side. I think you and I are going to be on about the same side. And there are going to be a lot of other people on the other side, and Reagan's going to win the election.
You're right.
I could be wrong about that. But we are running.
Well, the thing that bothers me, along with what these gentlemen said, is that both conservatives and liberals have sent in, let's say, to Pat Robinson of the 700 Club, who is maybe the most prominent TV Christian speaker. Well, both, you know, thousands and thousands of people have sent in millions and millions of dollars. Then he gets on television and uses, you know, the money from the liberals and the conservatives and says that, you know, he does the same thing. He says that Reagan is so and so and so. You know, that he speaks of his luncheon with Reagan and
my son tells me my son, this one on this side, tells me we lose the battles, but we're winning the war.